6 buildings, 3 locations. Our portfolio is valued at just north of $10
million. You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
All right, everyone, we are live here with Dante Belmonte, also known as Multifamily Madness, and arguably one of the coolest names of anyone that I've ever heard. Before I originally just asked him if it's pronounced Dante Belmonte. He's like, no, Dante Belmonte. And I was like, okay, that's badass. Dante, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, Connor. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course, man. I'm excited to get you on. I think anytime we kind of come in with like some of these young real estate investor shows, they do really well. And our audience loves to kind of get an understanding of everything from like, how did the first deals go? Like, what does it look like raising money? And I think you're kind of in a pretty cool position where you are pretty young. I think 24, you just said, and you've raised a decent amount of money at this point to get a couple cool deals done. So let's maybe go ahead and kick things off here with just a little bit of background, like who you are, some of the like high level stuff of like how many deals you've done, money you've raised, equity created, things like that.
Yeah, most definitely. So first off, Connor, really appreciate you having me on the show, looking to add value to your audience today. So again, my name is Dante Belmonte. I'm in upstate Syracuse, New York. I am a real estate broker by trade for the last 4 years. But as of recently, in the last 7 months, I started a private equity firm for multifamily real estate, raised about a little over $3.5 million a year to date to do about $10 million worth of deals this year. And super excited to share about that, you know, my adventure, how I got started, how I shifted into, you know, some larger commercial deals and go from there.
Damn. Hell yeah. Okay, cool. Let's get into it. So let's basically, what does your holdings or portfolio look like today? You said it was around like 10 million in overall assets. Is it like, is that span across like, you know, 10 or 12 different buildings, or what are you typically looking at right now?
Yeah. So 6 buildings, 3 locations. So that's our portfolio is valued at just north of 10 million. Hopefully could be more. I don't know. We haven't had valued in a little bit, but we'll see. So that's going to be primarily North Carolina. So all the properties that we purchase currently are in the North Carolina area, mainly around Charlotte, North Carolina, spanning out to the eastern part of the state.
Nice. Okay. So let's take it super high level to start here. Like, why pick multifamily to start? And maybe actually, I don't know if you know this about my background, but I own self storage. My co-host, who's out sick. I honestly want to say, Gio's hungover today. It's July 5th, and I think he was hosting like a big weekend long party. And so he's like, can you do the podcast today? And I was like, absolutely. When we were first starting out, we wanted to basically identify one of two things. One, what asset class? Two, where are we going after? And we started breaking it down where it's like, we eventually settled down to like, hey, we think the two things that will have the most opportunity are going to be apartment buildings and self-storage. Apartment buildings, because just the TAM and like the overall size and scale of these things is like just outrageous. And there's a cool little space to play there. Like, that's still sub-institutional and still above the mom and pop. And then the other one was self-storage, because just if you're on Twitter at all, I'm sure you see all the self-storage guys just like chatting about this stuff, but like there's a ridiculous, it's like 90% plus mom and pop. A lot of people aren't running it well, and there's a very clear value add play to be had there. So we kind of like settled on self-storage, and then backed our way in. Gio's from Rhode Island. I'm from Jersey. We've been traveling around a lot these past couple of years. And we basically reverse engineered our way into basically doing like, okay, we only want a property in Republican states. We own like, now we've got like, you know, 24 states or whatever here. Now we only want to buy a property in growing states. Okay, cool. Now we're in like 9, 10 or 11 different states. And then kind of like did some personal preference and things like that to like reverse engineer it. How did you get specifically into multifamily just in the North Carolina market?
Yeah. So really, you know, you kind of just said it, growth markets, you know, states that have population incline versus decline. So we did a lot of research, my partner and I, and we realized there's, and it's pretty obvious, you know, there's a lot of migration coming from the Northeast down to the Southeast. And we said, where in the Southeast is that happening? That's really going to be the Sun Belt. So, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, all those states that you've heard a bunch about. And then we said, you know, well, let's do a little bit more research. Where are we comfortable? Where has the type of buildings we're looking for? And, you know, that Charlotte area, North Carolina, definitely checked that box. But the second box that it really checked, and it wasn't even on purpose, was my partner was relocating down there for his wife's job. And so it worked out really well because he was boots on the ground. You know, I do a lot of work from up here, but, you know, I'll send him out to go see certain properties as I underwrite them or as we get offers out and things like that. So, you know, definitely targeted multifamily because it was an asset class that I've sold as a broker. I'm very familiar with. I know a lot about the product and how it works. Self-storage, you know, we offered on a self-storage facility actually up here at home. And if you know about the Radius Plus tool, we had an offer on a property. Then we, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to go check Radius Plus for something real quick. And there's 100,000 square feet of self-storage being developed directly across the street. And I was like, yeah, no way. So, you know, we lowered our offer, didn't end up getting the deal. Totally fine that we didn't end up getting it. But, you know, we've tried dabbling in self-storage a little bit, haven't really landed anything yet. And that's fine because that's not our primary goal. That's not our primary business plan. But we've certainly been making some really good headway with the multifamily and happy to stay with it.
When I hear a lot of these private equity guys and the real estate private equity guys talking about like asset classes, you know, we had Chris Powers on the show. We had Moses Kagan on the show the other week. And like, they're all very gung-ho on like only stay in one asset class if your goal is to go and raise capital, which it definitely seems like your goal is. Do you think you would maybe go against that advice early on? Like, do you have investors who have appetite for more than one asset class, or do you guys specifically want to stay in the multifamily space?
Yeah, early on, I'd say definitely sticking with one asset class because you're proving the business model. You're proving the model that you're trying to go after and executing on it, getting those investors their returns. And you don't want to stray away from it because if you do, you can get distracted. You can get, you know, deal merge and you can kind of get confused. And you really just want to stay on the path, master it. Once you have it mastered, you have teams in place and you have systems and processes in place, then maybe you can go ahead and describe it as diversifying the portfolio. And investors will be very happy to hear this because maybe they'll invest with you some multifamily and then some self-storage, industrial, triple net, retail, whatever it is. My goal personally is I definitely want to diversify into triple net properties in the near future, be able to maybe 1031 exchange my interest in the apartments over to triple net, and then vice versa. And kind of just keep bouncing back and forth again to better diversify the portfolio. And those properties don't take as much management. The industrial, retail, triple net versus the self-storage, the multifamily can be more management intense. Self-storage, not really on the tenant side, but really on the constant turnover side because everything's month to month and, you know, staying on top of your advertising and all that good stuff.
But why switch over to triple net? Because and you maybe just described it there of like it's less management, but it's also typically less returns as well. Like you're not going to get as high of a yield as if you find the kind of a diamond in the rough in the multifamily space.
Right. So that's exactly why we diversify the portfolio. So if I can spend a lot of time with more hands-on stuff with some better yields and multifamily, I can also push over a few hundred thousand or a few million to triple net where I don't have to manage it. The returns are very low and it's just on autopilot. And again, it's diversifying the portfolio. So that's kind of why we would position ourselves in that space. But you're not going to see a large percentage of our portfolio there because the returns are lower, like you said, Connor.
Cool. Okay, that makes sense. What I think real estate's an interesting, very interesting industry because it's one of those things where your first deal seems ridiculously hard, very stressful. It's like, and you know, there's a lot of legality things in it, right? Like, okay, I remember when I first had to learn what the hell a survey was, all of like the logistics of zoning, environmentals, like all of this kind of stuff. And it feels really overwhelming at first. Now that we're like, I want to say, I bought my first deal almost 10 months ago, exactly to the day. And you know, we own three properties under contract on a fourth right now. And so like, now that we're a little bit longer into this game, I'm like, well, actually this stuff is pretty simple. You know, it's very overwhelming because it feels like the mistakes could be like six-figure mistakes and you're taking
right.
a debt and you're putting up a bunch of cash and like there's these legal things that you like closing and title and all that stuff. And you're just like, I'm overwhelmed. Now that we're 10 months in, I'm like, it's actually a much simpler game than most other businesses out there. Yeah. I'd love to maybe get an understanding in terms of like what your first deal looked like, you know, how long ago it was, what the property was like, where you found capital and financing for it, all that jazz.
Yeah, definitely. So I have two first deals. And the reason why I say that is because I had like the duplex that I bought myself and, you know, very small deal. And then the second first deal I had was the first syndication where we actually raised private investor capital. So I'll talk about the first and then go with the latter. So, you know, the first deal was about 4 years ago. I was 19 or 20 years old when I first started looking and I had analysis paralysis. So what everyone had where you're just analyzing deals, but you aren't necessarily executing on those deals. And, you know, I kept looking at properties and I would make excuses like this one has that, this one has that, so I don't want it. And I was like, I told myself, I'm literally never going to buy a property. And so one guy that was kind of teaching me the reins, he had like 100 properties locally, and he was looking to sell a few of them, and he's willing to sell one off market to me. And so I was driving to the property, and I was just like, you know, I told myself, if you don't buy this property, you'll literally never buy one. You need to buy this one to get started.
Just to interrupt you real quick.
Yeah.
We had the same exact experience, whereas basically like, we had this property, we had the ability to go and buy the first one. And like in hindsight, 10 months later, the deal was a total win. They undersold it. And we got a very good value add right out of the gate. But at the time it was like, it felt like a total paralysis. And I think the one question that we asked ourselves that kind of gave us the confidence to move forward was like, okay, if we're not doing this deal, what deal are we going to do? Because like the property wasn't in the best condition. The market rents were low. So like it had a lot of like, it was a very big value add deal. Right. And like we visited the property and everything, and asking ourselves the question of like, if not this, then what got us thinking like, okay, like, well, I'm not gonna do this one. Like, what do we need to see to like feel comfortable, you know, sending a big wire, trying to get financing, whatever. And it kind of came down to like, well, no, the criteria probably looks like this deal. It's like, okay, great. So now we're just getting cold feet because we just don't feel confident because we haven't done it yet. And so that question kind of gave us the confidence to move forward a bit more.
Yeah, most definitely. So, you know, I was going to the property and I was just saying like, I literally, if I don't buy this, I'm not going to buy anything. So I don't advise anyone to do what I'm about to do here, but this is the story. So, you know, I met the guy over there. We walked through the first unit. You know, I looked at everything briefly for a few minutes. We went upstairs, the back stairwell, walked through the second unit, checked everything out, and then walked back downstairs. And I was just like, yeah, I'll take it. And I bought it with no contingencies. I didn't look in the basement. I didn't look in the attic. I didn't do an inspection. Like, I didn't do anything you should have done.
Did you not do that because of ignorance, or did you not do that because you just really wanted to get the deal?
It really wanted to get the deal, and I didn't want anything to stop me. And so luckily that didn't bite me in the butt because there was nothing bad with the home, thank God. But I was just super naive, and I was just like, I need to get a deal done, and I'm going to do whatever it takes. The basement foundation could have been completely crumbling in, and I would have never known, and the pipes could have been burst, and I would have never known. But, you know, that again was 19, 20 year old naive Dante. But I'm very happy I did do the deal, because the second I collected that first rent check, everything just clicked and everything made sense. And it was three bedrooms up and down flat, and then a three car garage out back. And so what I did was, is I rented out the upstairs, I Airbnb'd the downstairs, and I rented out each garage bay in the back to a random third individual for like $70 a piece. So that was adding in, you know, over an additional $200 of cash flow per month.
And to confirm, is this Syracuse or North Carolina at this point?
This is Syracuse. Yep. So this is up where I'm living. And I originally did it with an FHA loan because I was going to occupy the lower unit and, you know, rent out the top as an owner occupant. But, you know, some things in life changed. I wasn't able to occupy the unit. So I figured, you know, what is something I can do to, you know, bring in income? I could either rent it out or Airbnb it. I said, you know, I think you can make a little more money with Airbnb. Let's give that a shot. Cause I already had some furniture in there when I was planning on moving in, things like that.
Logistically, or I guess maybe not even logistically, legally, did you have to change the type of loan on something like that?
I didn't. So the way the FHA loan is structured is your intent should be to occupy the property. You know, if something happens in life or something changes, you can't occupy it. They're not going to call the loan due. They're not going to come hunt you down, find you, sue you or something like that. And so I made my loan officer aware, and he's just like, you know, your intent was to occupy the property. Now you're not. I don't see anything wrong with that. You're good to kind of keep moving forward with it.
Yeah. And the nice part about that too, is I believe if my understanding of that loan type is correct, you only have to go and actually live there for like 1 year or two anywhere. Right? So like once that 12 month and 1 day mark hits, theoretically you're in the clear anyway. If you made the loan officer aware, that's probably you're kosher.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. So had that conversation, we're all good there. So definitely started to make some money with it, and, you know, didn't look back since. And then that snowball effect. So you do that first one, the second one a month later, the third one another month later, and you just kind of keep going. And this kind of will stem into my second first deal. So started building up, you know, these properties, and then I saw how long it was taking me to build a portfolio and how much longer it would take to get to my goal of, you know, whatever it was, 100 doors at the time or whatever. And I was like, this is literally going to take forever. I have to purchase, you know, 40, 50 duplexes, triplexes to get there. And that's when I decided to stop self-managing, sell the properties, and use the proceeds to buy a 24 unit, but it wasn't all my capital. You know, I raised $1.2 million to purchase that asset. And that was in North Carolina. And there's a, you know, a bunch we can unpack there.
Yeah, let's before we get into all of the investor side of things, because that's going to be a big part of this conversation, I would love to maybe get a better understanding of people are going to be listening to this right now, maybe thinking about buying their first deal. And I think you made a good point about like, hey, go through the proper inspection side of things, make, you know, like figure out what contingencies you want, if you need a financing contingency in the contract, if you want a contingent based on like all like the title insurance and stuff like that. You know, make sure things are good to go there when you're negotiating that first deal. But for the most part, try to make actions. That way you're not getting that analysis paralysis like you described. What were things after you got under contract and after you realized that it was good that maybe you would have done slightly differently? An example for me personally was the big value add play that we're doing for these storage facilities is we're going in, if they look crappy, we make them look not crappy, and we add like the very bare bones fundamentals, right? Like every facility we've bought so far has not had security cameras, lights, you know, an operating fence. And so like all that in, depending on the size of the facility, roughly costs like 40, 50 grand. So like we put that in and it kind of justifies like a nicer appeal. We get better signage, like very, very bare bones things, but like things that make a difference when trying to go and sell a property. When you obviously move everyone over to like non-cash payments, credit cards, things like that. But the big thing that I didn't do day one early on is I was like we just didn't raise the rent for like 3 or 4 months. And all these people are month-to-month leases, and they're all like 70% below market. So in hindsight, I'm looking back on that. I was like, I was very nervous to raise around. I was like, dude, I don't want like 50% of the people to move out, whatever. We like for some people, and this, I don't know. I think mostly capitalists listen to this show. So I think no one's gonna get too upset here. But basically, like some people hadn't had their rent raised since like 1993 or something ridiculous. And so for like a 10 by 20 unit, which typically market rate was like $200, which like for what it's worth, we're raising it to the market rate. We're not going over. We're not like price gouging anyone, but they were paying like $30 a month. And so we're like 7Xing people's rent out here. And so like I felt really guilty about that. But I talked to the tenant and they're like, yeah, I kind of figured this is gonna come one day. Like that makes sense if everyone else like, and we sent all the competitors price lists, like let people know like we're not just trying to screw them or anything. So I think that's something I would have personally done differently is like follow the plan from day one and try to like take my own personal emotions out of it a little bit more. What about you?
Yeah, so I'm sorry, repeat that question again, just so I can answer it properly.
Yeah, the question basically, after you got through the actual closing, were there mistakes or things that you would have done differently that you think maybe first-time investors aren't as privy to that now you can kind of look back on and say like, no, this is probably the better way to kind of do things early on?
Yeah, so I feel like I did it really well. I really set myself up while I was under contract before I closed. I made sure I had, you know, systems and processes in place, you know, bank accounts opened, you know, certain leases in place, had an attorney review the lease and certain accounting methods. And so it all went really smooth. And I think I did things really well there. I think it's more of, you know, other deals down the line that once I closed on them, you know, wish we did things a little bit different, but that's, you know, you have to experience those to learn.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah. So like one property we bought, we hired a property management company and we didn't vet the agreement too well. We vetted it well, but there were still some things in there we were a little wishy-washy on, and we let them slide through and it bit us in the butt because there were some major expenses that came in from the property manager that just weren't justifiable. And we ended up firing them, going back and forth, and it took us months to get the funds back from them, but we finally did. And it's like we kind of wasted 2 months of the property when we could have been doing much better if we had a different management company in place.
So is there something now, like, are you, if you're hiring a new property management company, it seems like you're mostly in the one area now. So maybe like you don't have to think about this for a little bit until you guys try to diversify out a bit more. But if you're hiring a new property manager for a place now, is it like the go-to thing, like call references or maybe put something different in the contract that gives you more flexibility?
Oh yeah, most definitely. So, you know, we definitely call around, we see if anyone's worked with these individuals before. When we're going over the contract, we make sure that it's just about exactly how we want it. And we're much more clear. And that's because, again, we experience these things and we explain the story to them. Here's what we experienced before. We're not willing to do it. We're not willing to compromise on these points. Can we make it happen? And that's a yes or no. And then we move forward from there.
Nice. Okay, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's I guess maybe one more thing before kind of shifting it over to like you actually raising money and dealing with investors, and like I'd love to know like the psychology of a lot of that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah.
But where, with you having this broker background, where are you finding a lot of these deals? Are they off market? Are you getting any on market? Like I'd love to maybe know what your deal flow looks like and your process for finding more deals.
In like my hometown or down in North Carolina?
North Carolina.
Okay, yeah. So North Carolina.
Let's do both because I think maybe that might be more interesting.
Yeah, definitely. So great question. Locally, I've got really good deal flow when it comes to multifamily. And that's because I've spent years building relationships with sellers, doing mailer campaigns, hosting a real estate investor meetup locally where a lot of the investors come. I network with them. I get referrals from their investor buddies. I personally have a podcast as well that they listen to. So all those things in tandem really work well together. And so I'm able to, you know, one guy I know, send him an email. Hey, any properties you're looking to offload? I got a few guys that are looking. He sends me a list. I match up a buyer with every single one of those properties. Another property, I just got a call. You know, guy says, oh, you're the best guy in town to sell multifamily. I've got a 4-unit. Can you get rid of it for me? Not a problem. You know, that's a free lead. It costs me nothing to generate that lead besides a relationship that I had.
Do you have that reputation because you get the highest prices or where's that reputation come from?
Highest prices, most volume. So last year in Onondaga County, which is the county I'm a part of, I finished number one out of all brokers for multifamily sales. So that's buying and selling, you know, for my clients. And because of that, you know, I wear that badge right up on my shoulder, right on my sleeve here, where everyone can see that and they want to do business with me because of that. People know if they want off-market deals, they try to get on my mailer list because I have those off-market opportunities. And so I've spent a lot of time nurturing those relationships, building those relationships and finding those deals and those buyers so they can be repeat clients. You know, one guy, never met him, bought a property from me all over the phone, great property. He's doing an awesome job. I brought that deal to that individual off market because I knew the seller wanted to sell. I knew what this guy was looking for, made an off market deal, worked great. Then he referred me his brother, same thing, told me what he was looking for, knew someone that was selling an off market deal, brought him the deal. You know, first day he was looking, he had a deal under contract and we're getting ready to close on that one. So I could go over stories like that all day of how I've, you know, built relationships, nurtured them to grab deals, but I'm also adding value to these people and, you know, doing the meetup, doing the podcast, networking, it all comes full circle.
When you say you're building these relationships, because that's what I always hear on like the Bigger Pocket shows and talking to a couple other people, like, can you maybe just get a little bit more specific with what that means? Like, is that literally saying like, just checking in once, like, do you have like a calendar invite on your schedule, like once a month, just being like, hey, shoot, you know, these 50 guys a message being like, how's business going? How's deal flow? And just kind of like, just keeping the conversation going. Or is it more than that? Cause I know like some guys, I wish I had the exact name of the guy. Some Bigger Pockets guy that was on there like months and months ago. He basically said like, he has this whole thing around gifting. And maybe you know the guy, I think he's pretty famous, I forget though, where like he'll basically send like a ton of clients like really bougie nice gifts on a frequent basis. And he said like early on in those early days when he didn't have much cash, it was like a total hit and total killer in the bank account, because he would send like insane Japanese steak knives and like new suits and like cool trips for like the wife and the kids, you know what I mean? And he's like oh yeah, like it blew all my cash. But now I have the craziest deal flow I've ever seen because I'm actually like really maintaining these relationships and investing more so than just like a text or an email. What does it mean for you? Is it typically like a constant check-in and keeping the conversation going?
Yeah. So, you know, two things I do. One is I have my list of all the properties that I've sold, you know, buyers, sellers. And occasionally I'll just go through the list and I'll call all those individuals and just say, hey, how are things going? Just checking in. You know, if they bought a property from me, how's the property doing? How's it performing? Do you have any questions for me? Anything I can help you out with the operation side of thing? And then I kind of end it with, all right, well, if you're looking to add anything to the portfolio, I've got some good deals right now. Let me know. This sparks interest in them. We end up doing a deal. Seller side of things. Hey, you know, I sold that property for you. How is, you know, what'd you do with the funds? How's everything going? Are you looking to offload anything else? I just sold the next property on the next street over for this amount. They get all happy because they're like, wow, that's a great dollar amount. I wasn't even expecting that. Yeah, can you do the same thing with mine? So that's kind of like one aspect of how I'm, you know, staying connected, building relationships. And like I said, educating people that come to the meetups and whatnot. But like the other side of things of how I'm adding value is this one lady locally, she posted on Bigger Pockets of like how much trouble she was having with her tenants and this and that. And so I just reached out to her and, you know, I was like, how can I add value to you? You know, she was having trouble. I was walking her through how to do certain things with her properties. She was behind on renovations. I sent her a contractor that gave her some great deals to help her get her properties online. And because of that, I've sold two properties for her. I've sold a property to her, and she's invested in our private equity funds as well. I shouldn't say funds, our private equity projects. So sure. Just that little relationship of helping her out, just walking her through stuff on a phone call, sending her a contractor. I sold three properties with her, or did three deals with her, and she invested with us privately.
That's cool. Yeah. I wonder, like, I don't know. Anytime I do a podcast like this, I just think about it selfishly in terms of like, how can I use like what Dante's saying here to like benefit myself? And I wonder, like, honestly, even if I just go around like Dallas, Fort Worth area, and like, cause that's where we own some self-storage, just start calling some people, be like, hey, we just got like this awesome door contractor. Cause like the overhead doors are always a little janky and get a little banged up after the years. Like, yep. Hey, let me know if you want like a referral or something. By the way,
there
like,
you go.
Connor down the street, like just figured out to introduce myself. Might be an interesting way. I gotta maybe think about that a little bit more, because I don't know. I always get like skeeved out when people talk about building these relationships, and I'm like what does that mean? Like are you just calling? Like it seems transactional. Well, it doesn't really seem like a relationship, but when you're adding value and you're actually saying like, listen, like let's get on a plan to like help you get those tenants out of there, or like, hey, you know, I just wanted to give you the update. Like I just sold this for that in case you're wondering what yours is valued at. I forget to give you the heads up. It seems more helpful than it does salesy, I guess.
Yeah, most definitely. And you have to be careful with adding value to certain people as well, because some people will just take and never give. Mm-hmm. And they'll take advantage. You know, one example, this one guy, you know, thought I was good friends with him. You know, he, you know, wanted to take me out to lunch, pick my brain about real estate. He, you know, bought me some cigars, this, that. He was constantly calling me, asking me for, you know, can you show me this property? Can you show me these deals? Can you do this? Can you do that? And just a lot of take. And I was giving him all that stuff. You know, he was just taking it. I was giving it to him. And, you know, little things here, bought me a cigar, took me out to a lunch, you know, nothing crazy. Oh, can I come to your house to see this and that? And, you know, the individual asked me, can you pay to sponsor, you know, my wife's event, you know, and, you know, so I did that, you know, just trying to help this guy out. And the next thing you know, he does a transaction with someone else, completely unrelated. And I'm just right. Things like that. I'm like, why did I add so much value to this individual? And it wasn't like a normal relationship where he had like a question or two. It was like months of take. And then that happens and you get a little disappointed and discouraging. And, you know, my wife definitely keeps me more on track, you know. Why do you care? Just move on to the next thing. You know, you can say you did the right thing. Whatever they decide is what they decide. And she definitely keeps me level-headed in that standpoint.
Yeah, I think Gary Vee's got a good just take on it. And like, I don't know what your thoughts are on him, but I think he has the whole quote of like, just give without expectation to some degree. Yeah. Like is if you're expecting something in return just for doing a favor, like that's the wrong way to approach business. If you're just genuinely trying to provide value, like you'll find that like your luck multiplies just from giving a lot.
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, I say that story because that's one that stood out and was more recent, but I give a lot of value to a lot of people and I don't get a lot back, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But you know, I truly believe it'll, you know, it'll bear fruit eventually. It's a seed planted. It'll bear fruit and it'll come back to me in some form. Not that I'm always expecting it, but I'm really just happy to, you know, add value and help people, and they appreciate it. They tell me like, you know, thank you so much. You didn't have to do that, but you did. And it makes me feel good too, that I'm helping someone out.
Let's shift the conversation a little bit now into you starting to actually go and raise some money. So yep. At what point, like how many deals had you done prior to thinking about starting to syndicate money and find investors and things like that?
I did about six.
Okay. So you did six and they were all in Syracuse? All
correct. Yep. All smaller stuff. Yeah. Duplexes, singles, flips, Airbnbs, BRRRs. I just tried out a bunch of different things.
And out of curiosity, what age range was that from? Is that like 19 to 22, 19 to 23, something like that?
Exactly. 19 to about 22. So I was fairly young, and I still had some private individuals, like one or two people that were lending me some capital to do these deals, to do the renovations as well. So I was dipped my toe in the water.
Cool. Okay. So I have like six or seven questions here that I want to, and there's a lot of different directions. I'm trying to think about the best way to start this. I think maybe like, let's get into the thought behind raising capital in the first place and why you decided to go down that path versus just, you know, consistently going and buying a duplex or a quad every single year, stay local, you know, build up your reputation as a broker and stuff like that in the area. Why turn and decide to go and start Victory Capital and actually go and try to really scale things up?
Yeah. So, you know, if you really want to make a full-time gig out of this and you want to get real professional, you need to use OPM, other people's money. to scale, to get really big. Because odds are you're not sitting on $2 million, $3 million in cash. Not a lot of people are. And in order to do those bigger deals, you need the money to do the bigger deals. And so therefore you need to bring in private investors. And you'll be able to run a lot farther with other people's capital, grow the portfolio, grow the business, grow your net worth, grow your balance sheet, your relationships, and even you know your own personality within the marketplace. Being able to raise investor capital allows you to do that. If maybe you have a W-2 or a 1099 job that you really enjoy and you say, I don't really want to leave this. I like this job and want to make some side income. I think snagging a duplex, triplex, quadplex here and there, a flip on the side really makes sense. But I also think that business model is extremely hard to scale, and managing all these scattered assets all over the place that are smaller, you're just not going to get the attention I'm going to get on my 50 unit building. Your 2 units not going to get that attention. So that's kind of one of the reasons why.
And people hear 3.5 million raised, 10 million in assets owned, and you know, they assume it's a lot of money. And for what it's worth, I'm not knocking it all. It's a shit ton of money. But in the real estate world, it's not like a crazy amount
peanuts.
Of money. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm saying this as somebody who's like, we're only buying like, you know, sub-$1 million deals myself. But I would love to maybe know and share with the audience, like, they hear 10 million on assets under management, but like between the cash flow that you're giving back to investors, your gross margins, things like that, like, are these buildings primarily invested in and bought under the pretense of like trying to appreciate and really like have a safe spot for that investor capital? Or like, are you guys actively cash flowing like a sizable amount, and are you taking home a good chunk from being more in that GP role? I'd love to maybe know how that works.
Yeah. So, you know, these deals that we're doing, it's totally small potatoes when it comes to commercial real estate. Like, we are, you know, just about as small as it gets starting out with a small firm like this. You know, there's other firms that have 100, 200 million, a billion assets under management, and we're at 10 million. You know, we're just getting started. We're starting out the runway here. But, you know, we're cash flowing these deals. We're going in, we're adding value, we're renovating the interiors, the exteriors, aligning rents, charging what fees are allowed within that market that are pretty normal. And this will allow us to cash flow the investors' dollars. So they're going to make cash flow each quarter. We do quarterly distributions, and they're going to make some great returns. And what we do is GPs, we're more active. We do charge very minuscule fees to do the work and get compensated for the time and the risk we put onto these deals. Because, you know, we're signing on $10 million worth of loans. Personally, we are, you know, putting in $100,000, $200,000 in deposits in each of these deals up front. And so, you know, we're taking on a lot of risk. We're doing all the work. We do have to get compensated for that. And personally, I don't think we get paid enough sometimes for the amount of work that we do and the risk we take. But on the same side, we personally also own a lot of the LP units or shares. So, you know, where the LP puts in $100,000, $200,000, our capital is right next to them at 100, 200,000 because we're not only making management fees for not the property management, but the asset management. We're also taking LP dollars as well because we're invested just like a limited partner as well. So we take both sides of the pie essentially, but we do the work and we put the capital in place.
Cool. Can you maybe walk through a typical deal structure? Because I don't think like people hear fees and they don't really understand. Unless you're in that, you know, real estate private equity game, you have a better understanding. Can you walk through maybe what a typical deal structure looks like in terms of like, let's, we can use round numbers of like $1 million building. Yep. And then after that, maybe walk through the deal numbers of like just one of the deals that you guys might have done down in North Carolina.
Yeah. So, you know, the way the fee structure works is typically as the GPs, so my partner and I, for putting the deal together, finding it, raising the capital, putting the deposit down, signing on the loan, we typically take anywhere from a 1-3% acquisition fee. So that's anywhere on $1 million deal. That's $10,000 to $30,000 that we'll take at closing out of the capital raise for doing all the work, for bringing the investment, this great investment opportunity to investors. Throughout that life of the deal, let's say, you know, $1 million property, again, using rough math, cash flows, $100,000 a year, brings in $100,000 of income. We will typically take what's called an asset management fee. So 1% of that total collected amount as an asset management fee to actively manage the asset. So on $100,000 collected 1%, that's only $1,000 for the year. That's not money. That's gas money. That's to keep the lights on. That's to run like our portals that keep track of everything. Asset management fee, we almost lose money on every year, to be honest. Then there's what's called the disposition fee. So if we take that $1 million property and we, you know, make it worth $2 million and our disposition fee is anywhere from 1-3%. Again, let's just say it's 2% for easy math. That's going to be,
That'd be 40K, 2% on 2 million, right?
Exactly.
It'd be interesting too, if you on the disposition fee charge, 1% on, whatever the purchase price was, buy for a million, sell for a million, right? 1% on that. And then something crazy, like 5%, 6% on the difference, right? Because then you're super motivated. If I'm in an LP with you, I'd be super motivated to like pay you a high cut if you're getting like this crazy delta between what you bought it for and what you're selling it for.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea, but that kind of gets into the next piece. So that disposition fee, that's 40,000, so we're talking 30,000 upfront, 1,000 per year for say 5 years, that's 5,000 plus another 40, that's what, 75,000 for 5 years worth of work. That's $15,000 a year divided by two, because there's two partners, that's only $7,000 a year, 7,500. That's not a lot of money. So that's why you have to do larger deals. And then that brings us to the last piece, Connor, where it's the split of cash flow. So we give all of our investors, it's called a 7% preferred return. So that means the investors will automatically, not, I shouldn't say automatically, and before we receive a dollar, our investors have to receive 7% off of the cash flow on an annual basis.
So after $1 million deal, they get 70,000 guaranteed, locked and loaded. Not guaranteed, but they have set, assuming that the property cash flows more than 70,000, they are guaranteed $70,000.
Exactly. So let's say again, the property, not, we said collections before, but let's say actually cash flows 100,000 per year, or excuse me, that first year, they get 70% of that, 7% on their investment, which is 70% of the 100,000. So 70,000 of that automatically goes to the investors on a pro rata share basis, whatever they invest. And that leaves us with $30,000 left over. So after that 30,000, we typically do what's called a 75-25 split. So the investors get 7% of their capital. Every dollar, therefore, after the 7% above and beyond is going to be 75% of that dollar goes to them, 25% goes to us. So for a real world example, that 35,000 is left over, 30,000, we only get 7,500 of it. The other remaining amount, 22.5, I believe it is, goes to the investor. So again, that's going to motivate us to make the property cash flow really high, because if the property is not cash flowing high over 7%, we're not making money off the cash flow. So that year you can just call it quits on our income level. So we're really motivated to push 7% to these investors and went higher.
And if I understand the business model correctly, then you guys are very incentivized to essentially buy as low as possible, sell as, or not even necessarily buy as low as possible. You're probably pretty incentivized to buy at a reasonable price and sell it at a much higher price in a very quick timeline. Like, it's not necessarily like you guys are in the business of buy and hold forever.
Right. Exactly. We want to capitalize that with in a 4 to 6 year period. Now, one, the exception of one of our deals, we had an amazing offer come to us in 6 months of ownership, and the investors are going to get 26% on their investment in 7 months. If you annualize that, that's more like 48%. Yes. That's a phenomenal return in a market that's down 20% in the stock market year to date. Yes. So that's an opportunity we're going to capitalize on because we have a great offer in place and we're going to execute on it versus our other projects. We've had people reach out, but we're like, we really need to hold some assets to cash flow and bring these investors cash flow, because that's what they're here for.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. Do you typically put up a lot of money with the LP as well, or like, does it depend on a deal by deal basis?
Typically we will do 10% of the equity. So of the LP equity, I should say. So if the LP equity is 1.5 million, we'll put up about 150,000 of that 1.5 million raised. And that stays in the deal. We have to have skin in the game always. With the exception of one deal, we oversubscribed it really quick and it filled up. And we had some investors that were literally on their hands and knees asking for a spot. And so my partner and I gave up a portion of our ownership. So instead of putting in capital like LPs, we took some of that back out so we can give it to these people. And we want investors' capital working for them. We want them in the deals. We want them excited. We want them to repeat and invest with us. And that's only going to happen if we get them in the deals. So we're getting to that point where literally every single deal we've done so far has been oversubscribed and we've had to turn investors away, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, it definitely means you guys are doing the right thing. Maybe like rapid fire questions, because these are like probably like the yes or no, and I'm just curious why. It's like, one, are the LPs, do they have to go and sign liability on those as well?
No liability. So it's an entity owned by an entity and they don't sign on the loan.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I got to look into that more afterwards.
And it's non-recourse as well. Oh, non-recourse debt.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What is like your minimum check size? I'm curious. Like,
Minimum investments, $50,000. Okay. We have had two investors do $25,000, but that's because some investors did $75,000, which let this like odd void. Sure. So we only allowed it to repeat investors where, you know, I shot them a text. They said, hey, I need $25,000 for this deal. We have that trust level where they replied with, I just wired it to you. It should be in the account by the morning. They didn't even look at anything. They didn't look at the deal. We just had that trust level and they know our deal so well.
No, that's so cool. No, I asked this question specifically because I think my co-host Gio and I have this situation now where, like, you know, we're about to do our fourth deal, and we're pretty engaged in the sense of like we're at this point where we've put a lot of our own capital in, and now we're like, okay, does it make sense to start raising a little bit outside capital? And that's why I was really excited for this podcast, to like kind of learning to like how you manage things. The big thing that I think we're both very much on the same page of, though, is like we don't want to run into a situation of having like 8 to 10 investors on a single deal. I would much, and I understand this probably maybe limits the amount of big deals we can do, but like I would much rather find like, you know, a handful of wealthy individuals and say, hey, listen, I will bring you guys 1 to 2 deals per year each. And you know, on 123 Main Street deal, you know, we've got Jim Smith over here who's putting in like $400,000 alone. We're matching it with whatever else we're putting in, and like we just take down with like one additional equity partner per deal, because I don't want to have to worry about divvying up all the distributions and dividends and all of that kind of stuff on a quarterly basis for like 8 to 10 people across 5 to 10 different deals. Like, it seems very not fun, in my opinion, on that side. Like, do you typically try to, like, I don't know, require bigger check sizes in the future, you think?
Yeah, so we definitely will in the future. Right now, as we're getting started and trying to break in, you know, we said 50 is the lowest, unless there's an exception like we need to make. But it's really not as bad as people think. It's definitely upfront. The first few distributions you're doing a lot of math. And, you know, I was talking to someone about this yesterday. That's the whole business. The whole business is math. It's all one equation, whether it's an actual math equation or it's a people equation where you stick someone in here with someone else in here and you get out this result. Where we have a program that we just put in the distribution amount, like the total check that we're going to distribute. And it spits out how much is going to go to each investor, and it automatically ACHs them. So where it sounds like a headache, it definitely is up front, getting everyone with their paperwork filled out, their wires in, their questions, their complaints, you know, all that stuff. We haven't had any complaints, but you'll get them, I'm sure. It's a lot easier because, again, we take that total amount we're distributing, and it just spits out where it's going. And all you have to do is hit one button, that's submit, and it ACHs it to all of our investors.
Is that a software, or is it just like programmed? And
we'll see? So that's Syndication Pro. So it's a great program. So if you go to our website, Victory Cap Group, victorycapgroup.com, and go to the top right, it says Investor Portal. And you can actually just click that yellow button, make an account, and it shows you all of our deals we've done, what they're doing. And it's a great program, great tool. It costs a lot of money, but it makes us look very professional in our industry. Yeah. And it makes it very easy for investors. And I always say, you know, a confused mind takes no action. So if you have this real complicated process, odds are someone's just going to say, screw it, I'm not going to do it. So if we can make it easy for the investors, they should be happy to do it.
I got pitched a deal structure the other day. I'd love to maybe get your take on it. I think it made a lot of sense, but this is kind of probably still coming in from the standpoint of having like one LP per deal, where they said something along the lines of like, hey, listen, whatever deal you find, I'll put up 70% of the capital, you put up 30%. And keep in mind, we're only doing value ideals at the moment right now. Whenever, like, the expectation is that, you know, we split pro rata the capital distributions on a quarterly or whatever distribution schedule you want to make, pro rata. And then once we go and refi and there is a 100% return of capital, the equity split shifts to 50-50. I'd be curious to hear, like, have you heard of that before, and what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. So what it sounds like to me is a waterfall. So when a certain hurdle is met or a certain return, so in your sense, you're saying, correct me if I heard this correctly, if 100% of their capital is returned to them, it now goes to a 50-50 split yep. versus the 730. Okay. So that's a typical waterfall hurdle is what we call it. So for example, we have one in our deals where it's a 75-25% split, but if the IRR hits 17%, that drops to a 50-50. Okay. That just means if we beat expectations and our deal's doing amazing, we're getting rewarded for it, as we should.
Yeah.
Because anything over what we told our investors they'd be getting is a, you know, a cherry on the cake, cherry on top. So therefore, you know, they're still going to get a decent amount, but we're definitely going to take a larger portion of it because we're blowing the business plan out of, totally out of the water in a good way. I like that idea. You probably wouldn't be syndicating because it's one investor. Mm-hmm. You would probably be doing a joint venture. Just mm-hmm. be very aware that a joint venture, they can't be 100% passive. So you got to do something with them. Sure. Typically, we're like, hey, let's review some financials together. Hey, do you have an insurance contact? Just something gotcha. Where you're showing that they have some involvement. This is not legal advice by any means. Sure. You know, talk to a securities attorney. But it, you know, it sounds like a good business model. We haven't really toyed with playing with too many different business models or structures or things like that because we want to be very cookie cutter. Where when the next deal's ready, we do the same exact thing. Same yep. exact thing, and it just saves us time and money.
Cool. No, that totally makes sense. I got two more things we can kind of start wrapping up here. I guess,
yeah.
You know, you've been in the real estate game now for a while and it's been primarily, bull markets, maybe with the exception of maybe last month or two, yep. things maybe stalling out a little bit, and I'm not looking for market predictions. I don't think the smartest real estate investors in the world can really have those, but I would love to maybe understand from your portfolio specifically, like how are you thinking about protecting downside?
Yeah. So this is a great question and we've obviously been getting it a lot recently. Debt is the big question mark right now. So I'll round back to this debt part. So for every year we hold a property, I want three exit opportunities. I want to be able to sell the property. I want to be able to hold the debt in place, or I want to be able to refinance it. And that's what we're allowed to do on all of our assets right now. So, you know, for year one, you're really not going to do any of the three because you're getting operations up and running. Year two, our prepayment penalty goes away on a few of our projects so we can exit it. Or we can refinance it, or we still have it in place. It's fixed rate debt. So it's predictable. We know what the rate is. We can hold it in place. So that's year two. Year three, we can sell, refinance, or hold. Year four, sell, refinance, hold. Year five, the debt is due and we have to sell or refinance. So we still have all these options. And every year we're going to evaluate where the property is, where the market is, and which option we'd like to take. So this gives us a multiple exit strategy versus the guys who have floating debt rate, you know, it's not very predictable or balloons in only 2 years and they don't have extensions like we do because we paid a little bit more for the debt up front, but it's more, it's less risky. It's risk averse in a sense. This gives us opportunity to do what we need to do with the project. And we don't over leverage ourselves. We make sure we have fixed debt. And we make sure we have a bunch of cash in the bank. I'm talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in the bank. So whenever we raise on a deal, we get X amount of months of total expenses in the bank. So that way, if literally a dollar didn't come in on this property, we have enough capital to float it for months, 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 if not a year. And reality is you're always going to have dollars come in. So it's not like if we raise 3 months of reserves and something happens, we have to use 3 months in a row, you're going to have money that will allow you to kind of spread those things out to survive. So, you know, we're being very risk averse by being very picky with what we're buying. We're only buying, when I say phenomenal deals, I mean phenomenal deals. We're not taking any mediocre deals right now. Fixed rate debt. So that means it's not going to adjust on us. We know what it's going to be. And then having lots of reserves in the bank.
And it is still typically a 5-year balloon payment on most of these.
Yes, I think our earliest one is 4 years, but that still gives us plenty of time. You know, the market could literally drop and start to bounce back within 4 years. Yep. You look at, you know, 2007, 2008, that was a 3 to 4 year event. It was about 2007 to 2010 and still until we saw recovery. So, you know, if we bought something, you know, we bought three properties this year. If all three of those properties, the market dropped like a rock, you know, we have time to recover is essentially what I'm getting at.
Cool. I love that. All right. And I'd love to maybe wrap up now with like a big picture stuff. I always like anytime I interview young entrepreneurs or young business owners who have like big ambitions. I just kind of like documenting that kind of stuff. So that way, like, who knows, 10 years from now, you re-listen to this podcast and cut to that last 2 to 3 minute bit. and kind of see like what is the end goal for Dante, maybe like a 10-year goal or just bigger picture goal of like what it is that you're trying to build with Victory Capital for yourself or, you know, your family. What I'm curious where you're heading towards.
Yeah, no, great question. And I love kind of that accountability aspect of it. So, you know, in the future, I don't have like a certain dollar amount or unit amount we want to get at, but I'd love to wrap up my career on the brokerage side and, you know, 5 to 10 years, really focus on the private equity side of things, build just a well-oiled machine where, you know, I can turn off my phone for a month at a time and I can turn it back on and our business will still be alive, still be thriving, still be growing. That's where I'd really like to be at. I want to employ some, you know, some star players that are really able to take this company to the next level. I'm not looking to blow it out of the water, not looking to become a billionaire off it. I'm just looking to be comfortable and give people some great opportunities and do something I really enjoy. So everything I do right now, I don't view it as working. I'm very passionate about it. I enjoy it. It's kind of like playing to me and it's like a game and I love playing games. And so if I can continue to do that successfully, be able to provide for my family, be able to give for others and just be comfortable in that aspect, I'll be very happy with where things are at and call it 10 years.
Yeah. Well said. I think that's a common denominator from a lot of the successful entrepreneurs we've been interviewing lately is that the game is the reward, right? And so when you go for that unit count, when you go for that figure amount in a bank account, often it feels very fleeting. Getting good at the game and being one of the best to do it kind of, I think is a lot more of a, rewarding goal is typically what I
totally agree. On. Totally agree with you. Yeah, that's good.
Dante, if people want to go and they enjoy this interview, they want to check you out, they want to check out some of your deals, maybe hear you just rant about real estate and get into all those kind of subjects a little bit more, where can they go and find you?
Yeah. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share that. So website, victorycapgroup.com. So that's victorycapgroup.com. You can shoot me an email. I promise you I'll see it. Dante@victorycapgroup.com. On Instagram, @DanteBelmonte, LinkedIn, Dante Belmonte, but Twitter, you know, where we met and where I like to joke around and play, I've got an anonymous account is @MultifamilyMad. So Multifamily Madness. And that's typically a spot for me to just, you know, release, unload, network. And, you know, you won't even know I run it because I don't put the spotlight on myself. I just like talking about the business and joking around. And I think that's a really good place to do so. So
yeah, it's good. It's good banter. Good content, man. All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, brother.
Awesome. Thank you, Connor, for having me.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.